Well, glad you're here this morning. What we're going to talk about, we're going to talk about the gospel this morning in thinking about this text. If those of you don't have one of the books with you, it's Matthew chapter 5. And we're going to be, and pull the Pew Bible out because we're going to be looking at the Old Testament, some of the Hebrew scriptures this morning as well. Thank you, Dottie. Very much. Okay, we can start now. You're here. And would you join me as we pray together, as we say, Lord, help us see you more clearly in order that we can love you more dearly and follow you more nearly day by day. Amen. All right, day 229. I want us to pick it up in the top, sort of about a third of the way down page 437, where Jesus said, we read this last week, but this will be the context of what we're saying. I'm not sure what verse it is, but if you've got your text open, it's where Jesus says, do not think, all right? So follow along. Do not think that I have come to what? Abolish the what? The law or the prophets. He's going to be accused of that. What does he say next? I have what? I've not come to abolish them, but to do what? Fulfill them, the purpose for which God gave them, if you would. And he says, I tell you the truth, until heaven and earth disappear, not the smallest letter, not the least stroke of a pen will by any means disappear from the law until everything is what? Accomplished. And remember last week we said that the smallest stroke, the letter bet, it's got just a little, it's called a jot that hangs over the right side of the letter bet. The other is a little flourish, it's called a tittle, a jot and a tittle. Neither a jot nor a tittle will disappear from the law until I have fulfilled, till everything is accomplished. And then he says this, anyone who breaks what? One of the, not the biggest, but the what? If you break one of the least of these commandments and teaches other people to do the same, what's your destiny? What do you expect him to say? What might he have said instead of being least in the kingdom? If you break it and teach others to do the same, you're going where? Going to hell. Yeah, thank you, Amy. Amy's giving me the thumbs down. That's not what he says, is it? You're going to be the what? The least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever practices and teaches these commands will be called what? Great in the kingdom of heaven. Now, here comes the corker. All right? I tell you that unless your what? Unless your righteousness surpasses that of whom? The Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly, what? You won't even get in. Now, remember who's in the crowd? It's where we started. Oh, the Pharisees are in the crowd, but who's really listening here? It's Joe and Jane Doe. I mean, we're talking about your average Jewish person who's neither a religious scribe or a Pharisee. They don't consider themselves, in fact, they're looked down on. Galilee was a backwater in their minds, and these people who, these Jews in the Galilee, you know, they're so far removed from Jerusalem, they don't have a hope, all right? And so Jesus is telling these people that if your righteousness doesn't exceed theirs, what? You're not even going to get in. Isn't it nice to know that none of us have any hope at all of getting in? That's why when we talked about reading, it's so important to read a text in a context and try and understand the context in which Jesus is speaking. So tell me, or take a good guess with me, how did the Pharisees think about their righteousness as it related to the law? The best. Why was it the best? They what? They kept all the rules. And so if I keep the rules, I'm what? I'm all good. I'm in, right? And how about the Sadducees, the scribes? What about them? What did they know? I mean, they were the teachers of the law, right? They were the seminary professors, as Eugene Peterson wrote in the translation called The Message. These were the serious, they're religious leaders. And so yours and my righteousness has got to be greater than those guys who keep the law and these teachers of the law. How do you think the people felt? How would you have felt if you put yourself in their shoes? What do you think? Steve, what?
Confused.
Okay, because did I have any hope of exceeding the Pharisees in righteousness? I didn't have a prayer. So what on earth is Jesus saying here? Okay, now, you have heard that it was said to the people long ago, do not what? Okay, so Pharisees, they go, never murdered anybody. So what does that mean? I'm golden. I'm good. I'm in, right? And then Jesus starts talking. He says, anyone who murders will be subject to the judgment. All in favor of that motion, please say aye. Okay. But you've heard that it was said, but I tell you, who is he to tell me? Well, yeah, thank you, Frank. He's who?
God.
He's God. Okay. Why does he not start with the first commandment? What's the first commandment? Anybody know the Ten Commandments? What's the first one? Don't have any other gods before me. What's the next one? Don't make any images and don't make any likeness, okay, of my image. What's the third?
Sabbath day
to keep it holy, okay? I'll get to that in just a minute. So why didn't Jesus start with those? Because he was God. That's a good answer. I'm not really sure I know why, but he didn't. I'll give you my best shot at it, because being righteous in the way Jesus talks about, it's about our relationships with one another before it is about being religious and outwardly righteous. That's why he starts with the commandments swing on the, everything is about God down through the fourth commandment. On the fifth commandment, do you remember what the fifth is? It's not taking the fifth. It's, okay, it's what? Honor what? Honor your father and mother. Why? That your days will be long on the earth. And so your love for God, everything swings on that commandment of honoring father and mother. And now it moves out into our relationships with each other. Don't murder. Pharisees say, I haven't murdered, so I'm what? I'm golden. I'm good. I'm in. And Jesus comes along and says, but I tell you that anyone who is angry with his brother or sister will be likely to the what? Anybody in here ever been angry with some? No, not at all. You're safe over there. I'm not. Okay, and again, anyone who says to his brother, raka, that is an Aramaic term that of contempt. We could come up with some coarse, salty language of our own, but that's about as salty as it got. If you said that, who are you answerable to? The Sanhedrin. This is the Supreme Court. Okay, but anyone who says, you fool, you're in the dangers of what? How's everybody doing now? You remember when the IMAX first came out back in the, what it was, the 80s? And first time when Apple, Steve Jobs came up with, you'd click that thing and all of a sudden you'd have a whole bunch of things beneath it. That's what Jesus has just done with the commandments. Don't murder, I'm golden. So tell me how you're doing with anger. Who is he speaking to in doing this? Who's he trying to get at? All right, Frank says the people who think they're... Jerry? Yeah.
See, I think on most of these, he's speaking to both of the groups, to the crowd, but then you got people standing in the back that are the Pharisees, and sometimes they're going, yep, he's right on, and then the next time they're going, whoops, whoa. It's not right. I think he's kind of going back and forth with both of them and playing both of them.
Okay, if you're part of the crowd and you hear him saying this and you're watching the Pharisees start to squirm, how are you feeling? Oh, there may be hope for me. There can be some hope for me in this. In other words, how does my righteousness exceed that of the Pharisees? I've got to really pay attention to what he's saying, and I've got to deal with my anger. I've got to deal with the way in which I am likely to dismiss the value of someone else and call them raka, treat them with contempt. And so instead of just... So he is saying that is on the same level as what? Murder. Yeah, that's on the same level as murder. Betsy, how you feeling about that? How many of us measure up according to Jesus' new standards? Nobody. None of us. But does it really go down to the deep places of who we are? Yes, it does. Okay, now... Therefore, if you're offering your gift at the altar, and therefore remember that your brother has something against you, not you have something against your brother, but your brother against you, what does Jesus tell him to do? Put your gift down and do what? Go. And first, do what? Be reconciled to your brother. Did the Pharisees feel any need at all to do anything before they came to the altar and offer their gifts? No. What Jesus is doing, he's putting us all on level ground, isn't he? Okay? And what he is saying, our relationships with each other matter in terms of what it means to live righteously in right relationship to God. It's how we live it out with each other. Let me ask the question, is that always easy? No, it is not. I, back in the day when I was working in business, Jane will tell you, I had a kid that worked for me, and I would sometimes go home, and my happiest thought in the day would be to take him by the belt in the back of his shirt and run his head through the drywall. Okay? That was just my really struggling with that guy. But I will tell you, one of the happy things is when he and I connect on Facebook, and his name's David. And so I struggle with that, and I go, Lord, you've got to deal with, now it's not outward, where is it now? Where is the law? It's in here, isn't it? It's what's going on inside here that matters. Settle matters quickly with your adversary who's taking you to court. Do it while you're still on the way, or else he may hand you over to whom? The judge, yeah. And we've got several court cases in top of the news, don't we? And what will the judge do with you? Hand you over to the officer, and you may be thrown into prison. I tell you the truth, you won't get out until what? You've paid the last farthing. People who say, I've never murdered, it's easy to murder others in our hearts. And oh, by the way, it really doesn't matter whether I am a person of integrity in the way I treat people in our business dealings, okay? That what matters more is that I win than that I'm a person of integrity. Does that make sense to you, that what Jesus may be saying to us here? Yeah? Does that help you some to see where he's going with this? You've heard that it was said down at the bottom of the page, do not what? Don't commit adultery. I'm good, golden, never done it. But There's a wonderful story about Moses, goes up to the top of the mountain. He comes down from the mountain and he says, "Folks, I got good news and I got bad news. The good news is I got him down to 10. The bad news is 7's still in." Okay, sorry, that's bad humor. What is it? Don't what? Commit adultery. But I tell you that anyone who looks lustfully at a woman has already done what? Committed adultery. And the Pharisees are going, ooh, starting to sweat. Okay? Remember when these righteous people drugged that woman who had been caught in the very act of adultery before Jesus and said to him, "What does the law require?" What? That she be what? Come on. Stoned to death. What did Jesus do? Well, what did he do first? He knelt down, didn't he? The thing everybody wants to know was, what was he writing in the ground? No idea what he was writing. When we get to heaven, we can all ask him, take a ticket, all right, to ask him what that was about. But then when he stood up, he said, okay, and he looked at him and he said, "Let those of you without sin do what?" What did you hear? You heard the sound of stones hitting the ground, and you heard the sound of footsteps turning and walking away. And what did Jesus say to the woman? "Woman, where are your accusers?" And she looks up and he said, "Sir, there are none." And then what did Jesus say to her? "Neither do I accuse you, but go and what? Go and sin no more." Jesus, ethically, that is one of the most profound moments ethically. He could have said, "That's right, just stone her to death." Okay, he had to uphold the law, didn't he? Because it's the law. But he also had to have compassion on the person, all right? And then as she walked away, he made her responsible for her life going forward. Isn't that what he does with all of us in that way? Don't commit adultery. It's better for you to lose one part of your, if your right eye causes you to sin. Where does lust generally originate, men? Here, right? In what we see, we're visual people. If your right eye, in other words, what you're focusing on causes you to sin, do what with it? Guys, a bunch of us would be going through life without eyeballs, okay, right? And yeah, right first and then the left, okay, comes out next. What has Jesus just done with adultery? He's just raised the standard, hasn't he? It's how we focus on, we turn a woman in, or I can't speak to women in lust, but I can speak to men in lust. You objectify someone. And you no longer see them as a person of value the way God sees them. That's what lust does. And then he says, and if your right hand causes you to sin, do what? Cut it off. It's better to lose a part of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. Do you think Jesus really meant to gouge your right eye out? Do you think he meant to cut your right hand off? No. What does he mean when he says this? What's he meaning? Talk to me. Okay, all right, stop it. Do what? Would you?
Separate yourself from
me. Separate yourself. Yeah, good. Okay. Okay, recognize how serious this is. This is not a matter to be taken lightly. This is serious, according to Jesus. What else? Anybody else? That's all good. All right, in other words, if you realize how serious it is, what will you do? Yeah, you'll begin to make changes. How many of you have ever discovered that it's a struggle to do so? One of the great things about getting older is your testosterone drops. You go, there are some things for which I am very grateful about being 77, okay? Doesn't mean it's gone, but it's still, it's certainly less than it was when you're 27, all right? You realize how serious this matter of the way we relate to one another as men and women. Does not our culture break your heart with what's happening with the way human sexuality is being treated today? It's though it is not a gift of God. It's something we came up with, and we'll treat it however the hell we want to treat it, right? And that's what we're doing in our culture today. And my heart aches for the young men and women who are caught up in that mindset and don't understand I've got wonderful compassion for people who are trans. Jane and I studied with a wonderful theologian by the name of Ray Anderson. And Ray said, look, and Jerry and I have talked about this before, because Jerry, being a pediatric illness doc, epidemiologist, thank you very much, yeah. Ray said, look, when somebody's expressed sexuality and their essential sexuality don't match each other, he said, it's just fine. Fix it. But what's going on in telling children who are 9 years of age? It's insanity. It's cruelty to what's going on. We had a daughter who competed in women's water polo, a Division III, for 3 years. And she's one tough girl, let me tell you. Having women compete against mediocre men who can't make it on their own, this is absolutely insanity. Start your own trans division if you want to, so that you're competing against each other, but stop this stupidity. It's worse than stupid. Sorry, I'm getting off on a hobby horse here, but it's insanity that we're living in, and it is people who are trying to throw off the shackles that any understanding that God might have a role in this. We want that totally gone. We don't want to be accountable to anybody for what we do with anything. So I hope you, and I'll never forget a morning in Wichita, we had a cross-dresser walk into worship. He was 6'2", had on a pink mini skirt and a shadow around his face, and I've never been more proud of the congregation than I was that morning, because people didn't react at all, welcomed him to worship, and it was like, I'm proud of the way that you treated this person with respect and dignity this morning. People deserve that. All persons deserve that. I don't get the agenda that's driving all of this. So what do we need to do with these things? We need to understand how serious it is in God's sight, and then begin to learn to deal with it. I love the way he talked about his friend with pornography this morning. How did he treat this man who battled a pornographic addiction? Did he condemn him? No. What did he do? He gave him an answer. The Presbyterian Church was debating the gay issue for many, many years. And in Wichita, I had a gay man come to the session one time. And he was a man who had come out and had gone straight. And I said, come speak to our session about what it's like to experience life as a gay man. And he was wonderful. And he looked at our session and he said, the biggest problem of all are people like you, pointing at all my elders. Got 36 elders around this table. Everybody's going, what do you mean? We're the problem. He says, you're ready to condemn us, but no one's willing to walk with us as we struggle with this. That's what Christ-like people do. They walk with people as they struggle. And some people don't change. I've got gay friends, and I honor them. I don't agree with that. We're going to get to another topic in a minute that, an easy one to deal with, divorce. Right? So, next, I tell you, here we come, top of page 438. I tell you, anyone who what? Divorces his wife, must give her a what? Certificate of divorce. That's the law. It's what it says. But I tell you what? His wife, except for what? What does he cause her to become? An adulteress. And anyone who murders the, who marries the divorced woman, what does he do? Any divorced people here in the room? Anybody in here who's been through divorce? Okay, sorry, you guys, you know, you're out of it, you know. Is that what Jesus is saying here? Why is he teaching this? Because the Pharisees and the, yes, yes, Jane, on the back row. Yes, I see that hand.
Gave the woman not a lot of possibilities other than probably being a prostitute.
Yeah. What did a man have to, a Jewish man have to do to get a divorce? No. I had a friend who had been divorced two or three times, and I said, are you ever going to get married again? He said, no. I said, why? He said, half. Okay. I went, okay, I understand that. All a man had to do was write out a certificate, and, you know, Renee comes over, hands it to Amy, and Amy's what? You're out the door. And I'm doing that because I'm righteous, and she's not. She burned my eggs this morning, you know, or whatever it might be. So that was no-fault divorce for one person, the man, who had no standing at all. The woman, what's Jesus doing here? What's he doing? What's he up to? He's changing the rules. Who is he defending? The woman. And who is he poking it in the eyes to? The Pharisees who are standing around in the back going, ah. You know, I gave my wife a certificate of divorce. I'm fine. Was she unfaithful to you? Look, a long time ago as a young pastor, I took a very hard line on divorce. The longer Jane has had to be married to me, the softer I have become. We've been through all of the acceptable quitting places in our 54 plus years of marriage. She looked at me one time and she said, if this is as good as it's going to get, this is not very good. And that gets your attention. What's Jesus saying matters here? The marriage. The marriage matters. The relationship between the husband and the wife. For this cause, a man will what? Leave his father and mother, be joined to his wife, and the two become what? One flesh, and that word cleave is the picture of two pieces of paper being glued together. You can't tear one without tearing the other. Jesus is elevating marriage. How many of you say marriage is the easiest thing you've ever done? No, not at all. I tell every couple I marry, I said, this is the hardest work you'll ever do, but I'll also tell you it is the greatest joy you ever experience if you work your way through it. And every couple that I do, I spent an hour and a half with the couple Friday morning at breakfast. If couples don't leave me a little bit sobered, I've failed at my job, okay? Because I want them to understand here's the road ahead. Here's what it's going to look like. You've also heard that it was said of people long ago, don't break your oath, but keep the oath that you've made to the Lord. But I tell you, do not swear at all either by what? Don't swear by heaven. Why? You guys with me on the text? I'm at top of 438. It's God's throne. Don't swear by the earth. Why? It's his footstool. Don't swear by Jerusalem. Why? And don't swear by your head, because you can't make even one hair white or black. Simply let your what? Yes be yes, and your no be no. Anything that comes beyond that comes from whom? So what's the issue here? Oh, I can break my oath because I swore by Jerusalem. Okay, so I don't have to keep my word to you, John. I swore by Jerusalem. And so what you've got an easy out here. You got a back door. What's Jesus saying? What's the point here? Tell me. Be honorable. Let your word. Yeah, how many of you have friends who made business deals on a handshake? How many of you have an army of lawyers when you've done deals, right? You know, the lawyers are always the ones who win. Wouldn't you love to go back to that time where there's this kind of trust in the integrity? My yes means yes, and my no means no. One of the incredible privileges I had in Wichita, I had seven of Charles Koch's senior execs in the congregation. And I met with the guy who officed next to Charles. And one of the, even Charles Koch had a 360 review done by his underlings every year. And do you know what one of the core values of the company was? Integrity. In other words, if you said yes, you mean what? Yes. And if you said no, and you didn't follow through on that, and your whole value, your bonus in the company, if you got one, was based in part on the integrity with which you conducted yourselves in the relationships within all of the businesses that were part of Koch Industries. Very interesting. Eleanor, you just looked at your watch. What time is it? What time is it?
7:00.
Oh, gosh. Okay. Now you've heard that it was said, what comes next? An eye for what? And a tooth for what? Okay, but I say to you, this is going to get tough, don't resist a what? If somebody strikes you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. If somebody wants to sue you and take your tunic, do what? If somebody forces you to go 1 mile, go how far? 2. Give to the one who what? Asks you, and don't turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. Well, we'll just take we'll cut that right out of the Bible. So we'll pass over all of that. It is not good to give to everyone who asks of you. I learned that very early on, pastoring a small church in Van Nuys, California. We had all these folks who lived in the park, and the church was an easy mark. Oh, we're coming, and we want you to give us money. Should I give them money? No, why not? What are they going to do with it? Or shoot it up. So you know what we did? We wanted to show you we care about you. So we made a deal with the restaurant. We said, let me take you down to the restaurant and they'll feed you anything you want. You just sit down and you eat to your heart's content. Is it good? I'm going to step out on thin ice here in this company. Is it good to give your children everything they want and not expect them to have any responsibility at all? What happens? And we all know that money solves all problems, right? Yeah, and money never creates any problems at all. My kids, I think the thing that they are proudest of, we didn't give them as much of some as you can. We gave them a lot. But you know what they're proud of? They had to learn how to work when they were teenagers. They got jobs. I had a friend by the name of Tom Cummings. Tom manufactured from Nashville back in the day. Tom manufactured all of the big signs, Holiday Inn, all back when you had signs. And his son, guess where he started in the company? Sweeping the floors. You work your way up from the bottom. A lot of parents do an incredible disservice to their children because children don't learn their value and their ability to be capable if they're handed everything. You learn it by having to struggle in some ways. Is it compassion to give something, do everything for everybody, who need something. One of the people I got to know in Wichita was the general manager of Boeing. What a character. When he came to Wichita, they sent him out there to either shut down the Boeing plant or change it. So he went back and he said, we want to manufacture every 737 fuselage in Wichita, put it on trains, ship it out to Renton. And we want to manufacture one piece of every airplane Boeing builds. He said, one day I was falling asleep in my office, which I don't believe for a minute. He started the food bank. You know what they did in the food bank there? We don't give you anything. All of the grocery stores and restaurants gave a lot of food. But when you came in, guess what you had to do? You had to pay what? Something. Why did that matter? What did it give the people who came? Gave them dignity, right? I had to pay for this. So when a man or a mom goes home and says to his children or her children, said, no, look, I'm able to provide for my family in this way. That's a whole application. Oh, by the way, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? John, pretty tough. Why was it put in the law in the first place? What was it intended to do? What's that, John? Control behavior in what way? Well, I mean, just violence begetting violence, right? Well, no. So if John, right?
George.
So if George knocks out one of my teeth, how many do I want to knock out of George? Huh? Yeah. What does the law say? No, I can only do what? George, you're only going to lose one tooth. Here, open your mouth, right? An eye for an eye. If somebody gouges out my eye, can I take revenge on them? What the law is doing, it is putting parameters around how I respond to evil that's done to me. Okay, but Jesus says, if somebody strikes you on the right cheek, do what? After you turn the left, they strike you again, what do? You punch them back. Okay, I did left and right, now we're coming down the middle with this. You've heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies, pray for those who persecute you, that you may be sons and daughters of your Father in heaven. He causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good, and he sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. If you love those who love you, what reward do you get? That's an interesting question, isn't it? Are not even the tax collectors doing that? Then he says, and if you greet only your friends, what are you doing more than anybody else? What's the answer? Nothing. Don't even pagans, Gentiles, do that? Be what? As your what?
Heavenly Father.
Okay, how many of us this morning, we're going to have a quiz. We're going to check boxes and see how you're doing with all of this. How you doing? If you're like me, you're in a world of hurt. Okay? I want you to turn in your Bibles. Open one of the pew Bibles. I have no idea what page it's on. But I want you to turn to the 8th chapter of the book of Romans. Okay? I think it's the 8th chapter of the book of Romans. Somewhere I came up with this morning. Yeah, Romans chapter 8. Let me find the passage that I am looking for. Well, where is it, Bob? No, I know that. No, it's sin by one man. Oh, here it is. It's the end of Romans 5, not Romans 8. Romans 5:18. Okay, Romans 5:18. Oh, thought that was thunder at first. Consequently, as by one trespass, whose trespass was that? Anybody take a guess?
Adam.
Thank you, John. Yeah. You guys sing it out like that. As by one man's one person's trespass, Adam, what did that result in? Condemnation, okay? For some people, for all people, all right? So also one righteous act resulted in what? Justification and what? Life for whom? For all. For just as though the disobedience, through the disobedience of the one man, many were made what? Sinners. Would all the sinners in the room please look up at this sinner standing in front? Okay, that's what we all are. Is there any part of your life or mine that sin has not impacted in some way? No. Does that mean I'm as bad as I could be? No. Does it mean I'm as good as I'd like you to think I am? No, I'm not. Neither one is true. We've all been impacted and influenced by sin. That's just the truth about our lives. It's an infection that has come down to us through our DNA or whatever. But through the disobedience of the one man, the many were made sinners. And through the obedience of what? The one man, many will be made what? Righteousness. Righteous. So here's my question for us this morning. What time is it, please? 11:15. Good. Okay. What does an awareness of the law, when you and I break it, what does that bring to mind? How does it make you feel? When you choose to do something deliberately, or when you do something you didn't want to do, but you couldn't help yourself, what does it make you and me before God? What? What's that word? Guilty. All right? We are guilty before God. Why? What have we done? We've trespassed against the law. Okay? How many of you have committed murder? None of us. How many of us have been angry with somebody? Okay, condemned, right? Because we've transgressed the law. Divorce, nope. Some of you, yeah, you're guilty. How many of us have looked lustful? Guilty, all, you know. Lust is disordered desire. That's what lust is, disordered desire. When we do, what are we? Guilty. And why has all of this guilt come down on us? Because of one man. His disobedience has brought guilt. The act of the obedience of one man has brought what? Life for all. Here's the gospel. And the gospel is such great news. Religion is where you try and keep the rules so that you don't become guilty. Grace is the realization that Christ gave His life for us, and His sacrifice paid the guilt of what? My sin, our sin. And when I realize what grace is, does grace make me feel guilty? What does it make me feel, Art? Forgiven. Grateful, because I've been what? Forgiven. Do I deserve it? What's the answer? No. Heck no. I do not deserve it at all, but because God so loved the what? The world, what did He do? He gave His one and only Son so that whoever puts their what? Their trust in Him won't perish, but instead receive what? The gift of everlasting life. And so when I sin, the great thing is I can say to my older brother Jesus, Lord, I blew it again. And my older brother Jesus says, I know. I love you. I'm going to walk with you if you'll learn to depend on me. It's sort of like Bob was preaching this morning. If you let me begin to work in your life in a transforming way, what grace does, it makes me grateful. And when someone is grateful to God for what He has done for us, how do you want to live your life then? Huh? Doing what? Do what?
You also want to kind of give grace to others.
Why would I want to give grace to others? Because what? Because I've received grace, right? I've received what I don't deserve. What can I now begin to give you? Grace. But what does it mean instead of living in guilt and fear to live in grace and forgiveness and gratitude? It sets you free. How many of you water ski? Any of you ever water ski? Yeah? When we were kids, we had to teach ourselves how to water ski. And I discovered that when you fall, what's it a good thing to do?
Let go
of the rope. I'm not real smart. I didn't learn that the first time. When you keep hanging on to the rope, what do? You're sucking. I've got a lot of Lake Texoma water in me from all those days learning to ski. What's a good thing to do? Let go. Let go. What grace allows us to do with our guilt is what? Let go. Because God in Christ has paid the price and we are forgiven. And grace sets us free to begin to live gratefully and realizing that everything that God has given me, I get to live in this in a sense of adventure, of serving Him and knowing Him and going, how do I live this out? And I want to be as rightly related to others as I can be, knowing I'll never do it perfectly. It's why I need to confess my sin at least 47 times a day, right? Every week that confession's part of our life. If we say if we confess our sin, John writes, what is God? Two things. He's first of all faithful. And what's the second word? Wonderful word, just, to forgive us our sin. So I'm on trial and I'm dragged into the dock before God by the evil one who's bringing all these accusations. Where does the accusation come? Here and here, right? Done it again. And the evil one, what's he telling me about myself? Yeah, he says, yeah, you're doing well. If you've never read C.S. Lewis's Screwtape Letters, go read it. Fabulous, fabulous book. What does the evil one want? He wants to have this sense of condemnation, right? And as soon as he starts to accuse me, who steps into the picture? Who steps into the picture? Our advocate, our attorney. What's his name? His name is Jesus. And you and I go, guilty, and Jesus steps in, and what does He say? Forgiven. On what basis? He or she did this. I'm going, yeah. And He said, look, God forgives because God is faithful and God is just. And the justice of God was poured out on the cross of Christ. And when Christ gave His life there, He did it to pay the price for the guilt of all of our sin. So when God forgives you or me of our sin, is He being unjust or just? Just, because He's looking to His Son. Now, does that mean, and Paul's going to write in Romans, does that mean because grace abounds, therefore sin boldly and let sin abound? No. What are you when you're forgiven? What does it make you? Grateful. Free. Let go of the rope. Don't let condemnation ruin your life. Let conviction begin to change you and transform you. God is faithful and just and will what? forgive your sin, and then the next words, do you know what the next words are? What are they? Cleanse you from all unrighteousness. So when you and I make our confession before God, first of all, what happens to the charges that have been rightly brought up against me? They're dropped. And what happens to me on the inside when I acknowledge that? What does Christ do? He cleanses me on the inside. And now he goes on and he says, now look, if you say that you don't have any sin, what does that make you? Debbie, say that a little louder, would you? What does it make us? A liar is the next word. If you say you don't have any sin, not only a liar, the truth isn't in you, okay? Faithful and just to forgive us. Now, what is the purpose of law then? Let's just get rid of it and throw it away, okay? No, why not?
It was a reminder, perhaps, to give some parameters to how we could approach the righteous.
Yeah, that's one of the three great uses of the law, Frank. The first use of the law is it convicts us of our sin. I mean, don't murder, don't lust, okay? What the law was given to convict us of our sin. So the more you know the law, what are you going to know the more of? Your sin. You're just going to be aware of your sin. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? I think it's a very good thing because it keeps us from becoming pompous religious asses. All right? In a word, it lets us know who we really are before God. The second thing is, and that's where grace becomes so important. The second thing is, it established, do you know what is inscribed on the Supreme Court of the United States? Anybody want to guess? There's 10 of them. 10 commandments. Okay. Why are they, and they're inscribed in the Supreme Court in Switzerland. Why is that? Why? It's the whole basis of our understanding of covenant and law. If we didn't have that standard, okay, how could we become a nation of laws? Don't steal. I mean, what's going on in California? $999 and you're fined. I mean, it's obscene what's going on. And these laws are the basis of the fabric of a society, okay? And when those laws, when we throw them off, what happens? What happens in society? It's what we're watching happen in our country in many places and in our world. That's the second use of the law. What's the third? It really helps us learn what it means to live gratefully and godly. Oh, I need to struggle with lust, or I need to struggle with integrity, or I need to struggle with these things because they're really serious and they matter. And the person of Christ, when I realize I'm forgiven, I'm going, okay, Lord, here I am. Do something in me that's going to change me from the inside out. Religion, where does it start? Outside or inside? Outside. Religion is about keeping the rules. On the outside. Transformation starts where? In the heart. On the inside. Now, I'm not knocking religious observance. It's a good thing. It can be a good thing. It can be a bad thing too. But faith really begins where? In the heart. And it is this experience of grace that begins to change and transform you from the inside out. And who does that work of transformation? Who's your best guess? The Holy Spirit does. Yeah, as He indwells our lives, He's the one who begins to change us. That, friends, is as simple as I know how to make the gospel. And what the gospel does, it invites us to become part of this community of graced people. That's what the church is. The church is just this community of graced people, none of whom are perfect, all of whom need God's grace, need forgiveness, and we join together in this wonderful witness and celebration of hope that we have together. What time is it? It's time for Lauren to open the door back there. So what does, how does that help at all? How? Tell me how. Anybody? What's been, give me one good thing out of this morning. A reminder, good. Are you glad Jesus, yeah, John? A religion of works to a religion of faith, and a religion of faith is really a religion of trust. You know the difference in faith and trust? It's that dumb story I've told too many times of the guy pushing the wheelbarrow across and the guy on the other side. This is a true story. He pushed the wheelbarrow back and forth across a rope over the narrow side of Niagara Falls. And somebody gets to the other side and he says, "Do you think I can do it again?" And there's a guy saying, "Yeah, I do." He says, "Good, get in." That's the difference in faith and trust. Faith is saying, "I think you can do it." Trust is what? Getting in, saying you did it for me. It's a religion of trust. Yeah. Anybody else? Before Lauren opens the door. Do what?
He'll be shocked.
we're ready to end. So are you grateful that Jesus did what he did in the Sermon on the Mount? Now, the Ten Commandments, you'll find them in Exodus chapter 20 and in Leviticus 19. Let me encourage you to go back. All of those things that Jesus talked about, he took it all out of the Old Testament. It all came out of Torah. It all came out of the law. And teaching it to Jews, he said, "You've heard it said this way, but I what? I say to you." And thankfully, what he did, he changed all of the ground on which everything stands. And I find that incredibly good news. What we're going to do, we're going to start on Matthew chapter 6, which is day 230 next week. So let's just have a prayer as we end. Lord, thanks that we don't have to drink the lake water of guilt, that you are a good, loving, and just God, and that we can stand before you with our minds clear and our hearts cleansed because of what Christ has done for us. And you empower us to live grateful lives with a sense of adventure and hope. Bless each of my friends and the privilege we have of sharing this together. In Jesus' name, amen. God bless. Have a great week. See you.